Hello and welcome to Story Radio, the podcast for readers, writers and lovers of literature everywhere. Today we're speaking to Matthew Gostolo, editor of Silent Screams, an anthology of quiet horrors, which was published on 1st October by Ghost Willow Press. Welcome to the podcast, Matt.
Thanks very much. It's lovely to be here.
Could you tell us a bit about yourself and your own horror writing?
Yeah, of course. I by day I work in marketing in a university in the Midlands, and I have a background in working in local journalism back in the 90s and noughties, when local journalism was still a thing before it all went online, when there were still local newspapers, I guess. So I think that's where I learned to write to some extent. I think I always had an idea that I wanted to write for a living. It turned out that journalism was horrible. I just wasn't cut out for it at all. I think you need to be a very specific type of person to cut it. And I wasn't that type of person. But it did teach me a lot about writing, about, you know, just getting something on the page to get a story flowing. It taught me something about being concise. In fact, when I came to start writing longer form stuff, I actually found it actively quite difficult, I think, in some ways, because I'd had that beaten out of me. And it was, you know, journalistic writing is very, very bare bones, and it's very just the fact. But a long time after I quit journalism, I just didn't write at all. And then a few years ago, I want to say probably 2020, I just randomly online came across a print zine that was asking for submissions. And they mentioned in their call for writing, they mentioned David Lynch. And I've been a lifelong fan of his. And it made me think, oh, I could maybe write something for this. So I wrote a story that was about 350 words long and submitted it. And they accepted it and published it. And I felt like, oh, this is exciting. And so I started looking for, are there other places I could do this? And I realized I'd invented flash fiction independently, but that was actually a whole thing. Then I came to a forum called Writers HQ and realized that they were all writing flash fiction every week to a set of prompts. That led to a period of probably 18 months, 2 years of writing a story almost every week. And in that time, I probably published 30 or 40 stories online and in anthologies. So I think that's kind of my journey with writing. I don't exclusively write horror. You know, I dabble in poetry and flash, and some of it's funny, but I think I'm definitely horror leaning. Even when I don't set out to write horror, I think I end up there sometimes. It helps that the world's quite horrific, I think, you know, in many ways.
Is David Lynch your kind of starting point, really, for?
He's a huge, you know, RIP. He was a huge touchstone for me. Twin Peaks landed at the first run came on TV when I was 16, and I was immediately hooked. And then later I realized I'd watched one of his films back when I was much, much younger. I watched Dune, and in my head it was just like, oh, it's like Star Wars, and it's a bit like Flash Gordon, and it was just a sci-fi sort of space opera to me. And then retrospectively, I was like, oh, that's David Lynch as well. And then off the back of Twin Peaks, I discovered the rest of his filmography, and yeah, I find his work very deeply affecting, and I think the way he does horror is the sort of horror that really moves me and the sort of horror that I really enjoy. It's that sense that something's really wrong here, but it's not always easy to put your finger on what. You know, it's that moment in Lost Highway when the guy at the party set hands is speaking to the protagonist and says, "Oh, we met at your house." And he says, "I don't think I've met you before." And then he says, "Oh no, I'm at your house right now." And it's this really weird moment, like, what's going on there? I love that stuff, and David Lynch does it, I think, better than anyone.
Very unsettling. We didn't really know what to expect when Twin Peaks first appeared, and and then you start watching it and like, wow, this is completely unlike anything else I've ever seen.
I heard somebody say a couple of weeks ago that horror exists in movement, and that horror requires movement. And it really made me think that there's something about David Lynch. He can take, you know, the little man in a dream dancing, and that's all he is. He's a little man in a red suit dancing. But there's something so uncanny about the way it looks when you see it through David Lynch's eyes. You know, Bob coming across the living room towards the camera, and all that is a guy in double denim crawling over a sofa. But it's so horrifying. This, yeah.
Made me jump out of my skin when I saw that. Yeah, terrifying.
Yeah, very much so.
Heidegger has this phrase, the uncanniness of the everyday, which I think
Yeah.
probably works quite well for him.
Yeah. And I think that's the space I love. I think I find that stuff unsettling, and that's the sort of button that I try to push often in my writing too.
And how did you come up with the idea for your quiet horror anthology? Because it was that phrase that made me think, right, I'm submitting.
Oh,
I wasn't
okay.
hanging about.
That's very cool. So I think what it was a bit of a kick against something that I saw happening in the contemporary horror space. And I think it may have just been the sites I was reading or the presses that I followed. I felt like there was a movement of horror that was really overblown. Horror writing, this is, was very overblown, quite splattery, quite gory, and also quite almost ludicrous. When the Nightmare on Elm Street movies got into the sort of third and fourth sequels, and you'd get Freddy turning into a motorbike in somebody's dream, and it was like, it's not really scary anymore. It's just a bit,
Too meta. Yep.
yeah, exactly. And I felt like a lot of the horror writing I was reading was playing in that territory, and that's really cool. And I think there's a lot of people who are quite into that. This tongue in cheek, this knowing sort of horror. But I enjoyed a different type of horror, and I think the more I thought about it, it was defined by a kind of a quiet unease or a creeping dread. And so I wanted to give writers who played in that space a publication to aim for, and an anthology to be in. That was where the idea came from. It was a push back against something I saw happening, I think.
What do you think the appeal is of darker stories at the moment? Because they're having a moment, aren't they? I think they are.
I feel like they are too. And I think, I don't know, is it that dark times lead to dark stories? I think, it's, I think, speculative fiction, so horror and sci-fi, have an ability to look at the times they exist in through a skewed lens, where you can play with things, you can exaggerate elements, you can turn things upside down. You can lean into the disturbing aspects of the society you see around you. So I think there are probably a lot of people feeling horrified by the news on a daily basis. And, you know, perhaps it that comes out of our collective psyche as a surge in dark literature.
Did you find there were common themes that tie all these stories together in your collection?
I noticed that there were some stories that echoed one another. I think more than themes, there was a tone or an atmosphere that ran through many of them. And it's because of my curation, I guess, that I picked the stories that spoke to me. So a lot of them are potentially quite low key. There's not necessarily monsters, or if there are monsters, they may be more implied than seen. And I think often it's they are stories that move from normality to a space just outside normality where, in theory, nothing could have happened, or in theory, something very disturbing could have happened. And a lot of the stories, I think, leave you with more questions than answers about that. All you know is that you have probably felt a chill by the end of it. That said, there were some thematic echoes across the stories. There were several that dealt with a child's perspective. The narrator was a child, or the protagonist was a child. There was an excellent story called Rockabye by J.P. Ralph.
That was wonderful. That reminded me of a terrifying story. I think it's by D.H. Lawrence, called The Rocking Horse.
I need to read that.
But so, it's absolutely wonderful. You know,
yeah, Rocking Horse Winner, I think it is.
Rocking Horse Winner, that's right. Yes, it's one of my favourites.
I think I've read it. It's a boy feverishly riding a rocking horse, isn't it?
He's trying to make money for his parents, who are sort of very upwardly mobile, but, you know, financially sort of stretched. And he's predicting winners to his dad. But this story, Rockabye, is different. It's about the kind of it's about a child who's violent in a family, but who hides their violence. And it's very disturbing, but brilliant.
Really disturbing, and it centers around this object, this rocking horse, and it spoke to me because it reminded me that in my childhood bedroom there was a rocking horse that I think we inherited from someone, or it was given to us by somebody, and I never liked it, and it had this orangey bead for an eye. And I'd almost completely forgotten it until I read this story. And then I was like, oh, well, that's going in. That one landed in a really sort of, got under my skin just through my memories, I think. So, and there were other stories that had that childish point of view, I guess.
The one about the marsh is another terrifying one.
Yeah.
The Marsh is Full of Lost Things.
Yeah, which is by Sarah Turner, I think. A child who gives offerings of objects to the marsh, and it's all told in the child's voice. And there's something that I love about horror from a child's perspective. I think there's something really powerful and unsettling in it. I think because we've all been scared as children. So I think horror is perhaps a little bit closer to you when you're a child. That state of horror could be triggered at any time.
But there's also them trying to make sense of the world, and actually they can get it really badly wrong, but it makes, you know, it works for them, which can be quite unsettling.
That's a really good point. Yeah, definitely. You can... you have that space to misinterpret things, and you your imagination fills in the blanks, I think. And that can go both ways. You can either do terrible things or you can be frightened of innocuous things. And then there were a couple of stories that came at that from another perspective, including yours, Tabitha. And that was, there were two stories that very strongly came from a perspective of motherhood. And I found those. So there was your story, and there was one by Lindsay McLeod, who is a writer I adore. And I was so, so lucky to get one of her stories in
Mother Nature.
Yes. And they, the two stories were both written from the perspective of a new mother, but they did very different things, or they played in similar spaces, I think, but they came at it from different angles. And I think it's, you know, having seen my wife go through having our first child and becoming a mother, I think that experience, and you know, I'm not telling you how a woman feels, but it feels like that experience is on some level a test of womanhood, or that's how society frames it, and this is where you finally get to prove, are you a good woman? You know, are you going to be a natural mother, and are you going to instantly bond with a child? And actually, it's infinitely more complicated than that. And I remember in our house, Sophia, our daughter, didn't latch immediately, and breastfeeding was tricky. And we'd had all the NCT classes and all the breast is best lessons and everything else. And it led to my wife feeling like, am I even a proper woman if I can't do this, if me and my child can't do this? And I think those stories really resonated with those kind of feelings. And they did that thing that I was talking about, where you can take that seed of a very relatable feeling that many, many women have gone through and experienced, and then you just turn it up and turn it up and turn it up and make it more and more uncanny. And yeah, both those stories really, really were deeply affecting. They were great.
Thank you. It's definitely, I was thinking the other day that motherhood is like the sort of closest most of us get to body horror. It's kind of
genuinely,
you know, it's you know, and I think Lynch and other filmmakers have sort of played with that idea as well, haven't they?
Yeah, no doubt. Eraserhead is all that, isn't it? Yeah,
postpartum psychosis is having a moment.
Yeah, I mean, my story was kind of inspired not by a personal experience of that, but actually by reading an account of it. Okay. But it's something I've thought about a lot and wanted to explore in the story I wrote. And yes, I think it is definitely something that people are interested in, because it's such an extreme experience. And like you say, it can happen in the middle of what seems like an everyday experience.
There was a really wonderful description. I'm pretty sure it was in your story, Tabitha, about holding the baby and it feeling sort of ungainly and odd, and like it was all made of almost too much limbs. And yeah, it was really, really clever writing, I think, because it's this thing that, oh, you're meant to feel so natural. And actually, as a dad, I was terrified picking up my daughter that first 24 hours with her. I was absolutely convinced she had the tiniest toes. And all I kept thinking in my head was I was going to twist one of them round. I had this vivid image in my head that I was going to wreck her toes before we even got her home, you know.
Have you noticed any particular trends in the horror genre recently?
I mean, I suppose I feel like I already trod that ground a little bit in terms of what I was kicking against, that I had noted a trend towards this more overblown horror. I think one of the other things I've seen, and perhaps it's always been true, but it feels like a contemporary theme, is that horror is feels like a genre that welcomes a broad range of perspectives and authors from many different life experiences. I feel like there's a lot of amazing queer horror being written. There are horror stories being written from all sorts of international perspectives, and some of the authors on my ever expanding pile of to be read are I think there's a really diverse range of perspectives in the horror space right now, which I think is, you know, a really, really wonderful trend. And I wonder if it's something about the genre that allows those voices to be heard and probably draws people who have been made to feel othered to write it in that horror space, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. No, I agree. And I think that's a real strength, that it's sort of feels like a sort of an open genre which people, you know, which people can make their own. I noticed you had a really nice mixture of contemporary and historical fiction. Do you have a preference yourself, or was there any sort of did you make a conscious decision to include both?
Yeah, I think I must admit, a little bit surprised to find so many period pieces submitted. I wasn't sure that I'd get that, but I do feel like my personal tastes. I love contemporary horror. Don't get me wrong, but I think probably one of my favourite horror authors is Robert Aichman, and so that's pushing back to the early mid 20th century. Love Shirley Jackson. Going even further back, I love M.R. James and William Hope Hodgson and Arthur Machen, and so I'm comfortable with that, those sort of period settings, I guess. But yeah, I genuinely didn't expect many submissions to go there, and I was pleasantly surprised, I think. Especially there was one story that came from Terry Holland that was one of the period pieces, and I loved it so much. I made it the first story in the book. I thought it was really strong, and it took a period setting, but I feel like it did something quite modern with it. And it puts you in in the full horrors of war, and then in amongst all the blood and guts and gore, it creates this bizarrely beautiful moment between two men who were soldiers together, and then ends with a sort of fever dream horror sequence that really reminded me of Edgar Allan Poe. So I think it was the period pieces, I think, did the ones I chose did something contemporary with that. There were a couple of stories that were submitted that were almost a pastiche of H.P. Lovecraft, and they were very well written, but I didn't accept the ones that didn't feel like they added something new, maybe.
Yeah.
What are the particular opportunities and perspectives that the horror genre offers the writer?
Yeah. I think they give us a chance to I've maybe touched on this a little bit. I think they give us a chance to look at things askew and maybe learn something about them that you wouldn't look by looking at them through a flatter lens, maybe. So I feel like I've written stories about my feelings about work and living in a capitalist society. But when I look at them through a horror lens, or a sort of this gentle, quiet horror lens, they become about a guy who works in a clock factory, and he builds these clocks along a production line with all his colleagues. And then his brother works in a factory next door, and they have a production line where they get fully made clocks and they dismantle them piece by piece along the production line. And as the story goes on, you realize it's just a loop between these two buildings. And and that's all they're doing, is one team of men are building clocks, the other team are dismantling them, and it's the same 12 clocks doing a lap the whole time. And I think that, for me at least, in my writing, and I think in other people's writing, I'm able to say something about the world of work that's probably... that feels more interesting to me than if I just wrote a and look, there are other authors who can do it this way. If I just wrote a piece about how mundane it is going to work, I think that wouldn't work for me. But if I skew it and make the experience, this familiar experience, feel weird, then it feels like there's something there when you inject it with horror.
I feel like horror stories still haunt the literary canon rather than being in it. Do you agree? Do you think horror literature should just be literature, and we should stop having all these divisions?
Interesting, isn't it? I'm reading right now, for the first time in my life, shamefully, Frankenstein, which is, you know, probably...
I've just seen the film. Birth.
Oh yes, so I wanted to read the novel before I see the new Guillermo version. So I'm loving it, and it's the birth of this genre that I love so much. It's the birth of two genres that I love so much. You know, it's one of the first science fiction stories. It's one of the first horror stories, and it's considered literature.
It's a great read, isn't it? I mean, it's like Wuthering Heights. They're both fantastic reads, I think. I don't understand why sort of people sort of go, ooh, classic, you know, and they get put off thinking it's a classic.
I'm finding it an absolute page turner. You're totally right. But I think, and then I look at, you know, I was trying to think about the other day about how much horror is considered literature. And it made me think that perhaps it doesn't, it's better on the outside. It's better that it's not accepted. I think it's better that it has this, the genre status that keeps it outside the establishment. Perhaps that's why horror will always have an edge, because it's a challenger. It's on the outside throwing stones rather than...
scratching the window and saying,
For God's sake, don't invite it in. Yeah.
So finally, we're going to listen to Terry Holland reading his stories. You've already mentioned it, of course, but perhaps could you just give a little introduction?
Yes.
To Terry's work.
So Terry Holland is a writer who I met through the Writers' Headquarters Forum. He is a really lovely bloke, but also a very, very talented writer. He has a wonderful way of seeing the world. I think he seems to be able to turn his hand to many different styles of writing. He also writes some of the best titles for stories that are almost stories in themselves. But he can take the smallest incident and turn it into a vast social commentary. He can turn a story about walking through the streets of a specific area of London into a sprawling psychogeography that brings Victorian era and contemporary era clashing together with, you know, in remarkable ways. And this story, I think, is is just a dazzling piece of writing. I think when I compare it to Edgar Allan Poe, that is the highest possible praise from me. Poe's writing, I think, is something really, really, truly magical. Without this story feeling like a pastiche, there is something of that feverish horror that Terry manages to capture. I think it's a remarkable story.
Fantastic. Oh, well, we'll listen to that after the show. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, Matt. It was really interesting to talk to you. And The anthology is Silent Screams, an anthology of quiet horrors. Please do read it. There's some fantastic stories in there. Thank you so much.
Thank you
very much.
Nice to meet you both.
Barnabas Coolstock's Last Wish, written and read by Terry Holland. A fire rages through my body. Is this a foretaste of the afterlife, burning in everlasting flame as punishment for my unnatural act? The bed is awash with sweat. The thin blanket clings to my skin. I shiver and tremble as though plunged in icy water, even as I feel I am being boiled alive. Martha lays a wet cloth on my brow, but it brings little ease. Water gushes from my every pore, yet my throat is choked and dry as dust. Martha holds a cup of water to my lips. I try to drink, but can scarce muster the effort to swallow. I know my time in this vale of tears is near done. I cling to what little life is left in me, only for fear of the hell fire that surely awaits. Martha's face hangs above me, blurred and shape-shifting. Wife and mother, helpmeet and lover, angel and demon, saviour and tormentor. The box, I breathe. Bring me the box. I sense Martha's revulsion. I grip her wrist with a strength I am surprised I still possess. She recoils, gasping, "Very well, Barnabas. Just let go." I hear her footsteps cross the uneven floor, the chest creak open, indistinct sounds, then silence. A few moments only, yet in my fevered imagination stretched to an infinity of catastrophic imaginings. Martha! My voice a rasping croak, again confusing indistinct sounds, then a deep sigh. The creak of the chest closing. Footsteps. She has been a good wife to me, dutiful to the last, in spite of it all. No doubt she will receive her reward in heaven. She places the box on my fevered chest, its weight immense and crushing, yet also too insubstantial for what it contains, like life itself. As my fingertips touch the rough oak, memories of that dreadful day tumble past my mind's eye. I see my comrade, brother in arms, closest friend and dearest companion throughout that long gone world of war, Robert Strangfellow, cling fiercely to his pike as it speared through the breastplate of the crazed royalist commander, who recklessly, pointlessly charged straight into our ranks, eyes wild, the anguished neighs of his poor horse for some moments drowning out even the roar of the guns and the screams of maimed and dying men. I see that demented officer's sword arc down in one final desperate swing, blade glinting, cleaving through the air, then through Robert Strangfellow's pike, then through Robert Strangfellow's beautiful, sturdy left arm. In that instant, all noise was hushed. Nothing existed but Robert Strangfellow's wide-eyed amazement as he watched his hand fall to the ground, still clutching a length of pike shaft. He collapsed, it seemed to me with impossible slowness, grabbing at his bloody stump, a cry emanating from the core of his being that pierces me to this day. As I rushed to his aid, a shell exploded in our midst, taking my leg from under me. I fell atop my fallen comrade. The time after that is a blur, a smear of pain and delirium. I remember waking in a barn, myself and Robert Strangfellow crushed together among piles of dead, dying and wounded. Bloody, filthy rags where our missing limbs had been. In that fevered halfway house, that terrible threshold between life and death, we loved, Robert Strangfellow and I. Loved true and deep, body and soul. Loved as it is forbidden for men to love. 'Twas his last act upon this accursed earth. The fire within me is burning out. I hear a woman's voice in prayer. Martha is kneeling beside the bed, hands clenched, head bowed. I open the box. Martha looks up at me, but the face I see is not hers, nor is the last breath that brushes past my ear, nor are the tender fingertips that caress my hollow cheek one final time.